Bill Doggett, next to Tim, is an exhibitions curator, independent archivist, and lecturer based in Oakland, California. And he also happens to be the nephew and namesake of the R&B musician Bill Doggett. He's the...
Thanks.
He is the 2012 recipient of the Heritage Keepers Award for his exhibitions and archive work by the Bay Area Friends of Negro Spirituals. His 2013 exhibition called The Journey to Freedom was mounted at the San Francisco Bayview Opera House. And his exhibition, Porgy and Bess, From Broadway to San Francisco, was displayed at the San Francisco Opera House in 2009. Doggett was also on the founding board of directors for the LA Opera's African Americans for LA Opera Division. He was inspired by the African American archivist Arthur Schomburg, and Doggett's goal is to lecture and create an educational outreach resource embellished by his archive of rare historical ephemera and recordings, the latter of which focus on black concert singers of the 1930s to 1950s, on Negro spirituals and minstrel songs. The title of his presentation is Emancipation Proclamation, From Minstrel Coon Songs to Negro Spirituals. Please welcome to ours for the first time, Bill Doggett.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I believe I have a lavalier that's going to have some sound on it. I don't hear it yet, but okay, I guess it's coming up. These things happen. And we'll let Tim take his computer, and I will put mine on. So this is, sorry? Yes, okay. All right, so this is for?
That's the headphone jack.
Okay. Okay, great. I don't think I'm going to use sound, so I don't think it's an issue. Okay, so actually, let me make sure that before we start that I have all of this up and running correctly. You can hear me okay? Actually, I think this just fell out. So, okay, I'm going to need to, can you help me with this? It fell out when we're transferring the computers. So while we're waiting for this to sync and these things happen in any kind of presentation, it's really, I want to take a moment to say thank you to Carrie Gunnell for inviting me from Oakland, California to participate. It's very important, as I've had an opportunity to enjoy my first bars, to recognize that there are so many different perspectives. I think the scholarship and the research and all of the fund-to-grant projects that I'm learning about, especially the field recordings, as we're talking about Alan Lomax and all of that, and the Michigan trips. I think this is really critical information, and I think it's wonderful that I'm here, but there's so many other African-American, Latino, Asian-Pacific American scholars that would love also to be part of this. So I'm hopeful that I can, by my participation in this event, share news about ours, because I know that there are many people that would like to know about ours. So the title has actually tweaked a little bit. It is the same topic, but it's Emancipation Proclamation, Race, Image, and Sound, From Minstrelsy and Coon Songs to Negro Spirituals. And a lot of what I will be talking about, I am one of these university lecture speakers that is, very passionate and very expressive, but because of our time frame, I'm not going to do the kind of longer-term talking that I would normally do, but I will read from my script. But we'll start with this simple idea that there is a whole duality. There's, if you will, a dual, I approach it from an academic point of view, this dialectic, this from darkness to lightness, that is very much a part of this whole exploration point of view that I am bringing to this subject. So part of that will be showcased really brilliantly in a very quick 2.5-minute video clip that you'll see now.
Well, Mr. Bones, how are you this evening?
Me? I'm the personification of health, Mr. Christie.
Good. Who was that lady I saw you with this afternoon?
That was no lady. That was my wife.
Thank you.
take off. You know you're lucky.
So that is the first clip. There are two clips that I'll be showcasing. So why did I do that? Why did I showcase this? I wanted to showcase, I talked about duality, so talk about these two competing images of real and unreal. So that, the last piece being from Emperor Jones, the end titles and credits, showcase an African reality transformed into an American reality actually out of the Gullah culture, which is in the Carolinas, and an experience of the African-American spiritual and through image that is by quite sharp contrast to the more popular image that you would see in media and entertainment throughout from the time of basically the 1830s all the way through, as Tim is so right to say, through the 50s, through 50s TV of Amos and Andy. So I'm going to go and begin with this image, which I begin with most of my lectures, is that this is an image of reality. This is an early photograph of what it was to be black and to look and experience being in the fields in the Deep South. But it also speaks to this, and I hope you can hear me okay, it speaks to what the essential opening words of my topic are, which is Emancipation Proclamation. So the years 2013 and 15 are historic in their commemorations of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. It's in Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, and the Civil War's climactic and final victim, the assassinated President Abraham Lincoln. But 2013 also witnessed national commemorations of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which was an executive order issued in war times by the Commander-in-Chief as a war strategy to eviscerate the economic and cultural foundation of the Confederacy, which was slavery. Slavery symbolically ended with the ratification of the 14th Amendment by Congress in December 1865. We'll hear more about that next year, in December 2015. However, slavery for a race of freed Africans continued in image and sound for nearly 100 years. That's why I specifically opened in that way. Thus, we enter kind of the world of dualities, dueling contrasts of what it was to be African / African American, a world of two dialectics, imagined and nostalgic, and authentic but suppressed. Two worlds, imagined and real, a dialectic from darkness, in a prism of darkness of minstrelsy and coon songs, to the bright light of a reclaiming of a cultural identification and a spiritual redemption in the form of Negro spiritual. So enter the world of minstrelsy. Jim Crow, Zip Coon, Thomas Rice, Stephen Foster, Dan Emmett. So where did minstrelsy come from? What is minstrelsy? Minstrelsy is a theatrical entertainment, a unique amalgam and convergence of influences, imitations, and sources originating from youthful Irish males in New York in the 1830s, poking fun at social classism. Tim remarked about that, Tim, or at least alluded to that, and I'm going on to say, from youthful Irish males in New York in the 1830s, poking fun at social classism, of British and Irish classism and aristocracy, as well as African slaves imitating the refined ways of their white slave masters. Minstrelsy is, by its source, a mixed-race concoction of reverse and converse self-mockery, both white and black. Thomas D. Rice, who's pictured here in the frame here, was a New York Bowery District Irishman. He's credited as the father of minstrelsy, created simply a new entertainment, a youthful man looking to make his mark on the world in entertainment, had an idea, was exposed through some of his travels out into the Wild West, which was further than Ohio, had exposure to runaway slaves, fugitive slaves. You know, this is this whole concoction of things that becomes minstrelsy. As entertainment, Rice donned burnt cork, blackface, as both a theatrical and political device for humor. Added to the humor were the songs, in particular the most famous of the T.D. Rice songs, Jump Jim Crow, and the Jump Jim Crow routine, which Tim has remarked on. In the expansive literature on minstrelsy and historically, the original intent of Rice's Jim Crow routines were mixed in intention. Minstrelsy was a 19th century version of Saturday Night Live, but not intended in its first outings as a social and political device for race suppression. Moreover, the literature points out quite convincingly, the imagined or fictional nature of minstrelsy as entertainment and as document of black slave life. That is to say, T.D. Rice never did, and this would be interesting as we're talking about what Alan Lomax did with all of the field recordings and all of the research. So T.D. Rice never did authenticating field research at southern plantations for his skits, nor did the chief early exponent of early minstrel music, Stephen Collins Foster, who you've heard about. Foster's music is, I'll go to some of the images of Foster, there's Foster. Okay. So Foster's music is in text and stage realization by the Christy Minstrels, which you just saw some of their sheet music. Actually, there was this interesting business connection, if you will, between the Christy Minstrels and Stephen Foster. They collaborated. The music of the Christy Minstrels of the 1840s, 50s really came essentially from Stephen Foster. So going forward to Stephen Foster, so back here. So Foster's music and text and stage realizations by the Christy Minstrels of the 1840s and 50s were idealized nostalgia based on an impressionism. Foster had not been doing field work in the Deep South in the 1830s and 40s upon which to base these highly nostalgic and highly imagined impressions that his songs, you know, basically in terms of text created. So yet the success of the Impressionism, paired with the demand for raucous and fun entertainment of a pioneering young America, propelled this peculiar institution forward to a level of pre-Civil War success and demand that took on a pro-slavery and an anti-slavery political meaning. I'm showcasing some of the items out of my collection. I'm also an archivist and have a lot of original historical material. So this is one of the earliest recordings of Suwannee River. This is a 5-inch, I think, a 5-inch Victor. 7-inch, excuse me, I'm sorry, 7-inch Victor. So, but going on, so during the 1850s, this is an interesting slide to showcase. During the 1850s, Jim Crow and Zip Coon, the creation of Irish immigrant entertainers, became concretized in a national consciousness with a new political meaning. Jim Crow, the buffoonish African slave, here on the left in dark, that's actually T.D. Rice in blackface, Jim Crow, the buffoonish African slave not to be taken seriously as a human being, and Zip Coon on the right, the free black, who, quote, acted white or put on airs, but seen through fancy clothes that he has as nothing more than a pretend Jim Crow. Both caricatures became important political pawns of fact, not fiction, in the heated debate around pro and anti-slavery movements. Fast forward to 1870, in the wake of Lincoln's assassination, Reconstruction's face of a Northern victory over Confederacy took critical form in the Freedmen's Bureau and the placement of federal troops in the southern states. Eviscerated white men of the former Confederacy reacted bitterly to the defeat of the war and pointed distaste to the former slaves, their former slaves, now as congressmen representing their ruined states in the nation's capital. Efforts to reverse Lincoln identified social progressiveness became political reality with the contested election of 1876, where Republican Rutherford B. Hayes prevailed in a razor-close election, with the compromise that Hayes would end Lincoln's Reconstruction by withdrawing federal troops and overseers and allow Southern states states' rights, that's first when you're hearing about states' rights, to self-determine their social and economic issues. For former Confederate states now free of Reconstruction, re-emerging at the center of identity once again was the status of Negro slaves. They had just fought a civil war, but yet once again the status of the Negro slave now symbolically free. Inner Kuhnsongs and repressive laws of Jim Crow of the 1880s and 90s. Kuhnsongs were, and this is one of the great classic ones, this is Lou Dockstetter in the inset here, Kuhn, 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 words by Gene Jefferson, music by Leo Friedman, the great hit of 1901. Kuhnsongs were a continuation of antebellum minstrelsy, but with new and intentional negative cultural and political intent. The cuteness of minstrelsy shows gave way to a wayward excessiveness, an exaggeration, a pervasive social, cultural put-down of black men, women, and children as characters, not real people, worthy of either the equal rights or equal protections that had been afforded them by the beloved assassinated President Lincoln. So white entertainers who championed the Kuhnsongs, and these are some of my items. I have a very large collection of Kuhnsongs and minstrel songs that I actually showcase in some of the lectures I do for young people, in at least in California. I have a suitcase Victrola, and I bring out these to as a show and tell, and it really gets a lot of attention. You know, the songs, the Kuhnsongs demonstrated this extreme interest, you know, this extreme degradation, at least from an African-American point of view, Kuhn, Kuhn, Kuhn being one of the most famous songs. Another, of course, is Collins and Harlan. You know, we talk about people, about acts, entertainers, and recording artists that had careers around this. And, of course, Collins and Harlan and Victor were very famous. Nigger Loves His Possum is one of the, we know, one of the huge hits that they had. This is also difficult, and I use this particular image. This is hard to find. I've had only two copies of it. The one I have is to showcase it. Flo Irwin at the Orpheum. You could buy this in the San Francisco Examiner. I'll Carve That Nigger When We Meet. Another one, Nigger Blues, by Leroy, showcased by Leroy White. May Irwin. Flo and May Irwin are Irish, is interesting, and not a lot of people have pointed this out, but they were the queens of the Kuhnsongs. And this is from my collection. It's the front piece of May Irwin's famous Bully song. But the challenge here, and it's autographed, and the challenge here on this is that this becomes, and the Kuhnsong becomes more than just folly in visual and in tone. It becomes a statement of political, statement of political intention. I'll just leave it that way on an academic level. Here's another one. It's very similar to the previous one, May Irwin's Bully Song. Here's another one, the Kuhn that had the razor. So it falls into this whole idea that there was some kind of danger to have slaves, these former, you know, slaves are now free, but it basically points to a social and political idea that was perhaps not originally intended, but then became very clearly intended to make a statement that was difficult for the people who were represented by the image. So let's go on this. So white entertainers who championed the Kuhnsong rage included the famous Lou Dockstetter, Flo and May Irwin. I've talked about, let's go forward to W.H., this is an image here, W.H. West, Tom Lewis, Charles Ernest, George M. Cohen, the Harris Minstrels, and of course, myriad others. Then we come to the fact that, as has already been mentioned, the world of minstrel show and Kuhnsongs have become the prevailing popular American entertainment. By the late 1870s, minstrel shows and Kuhnsongs were an economic behemoth that was unstoppable. It was the prevailing entertainment. If you were an actor or a musician and wanted to be booked in a theater, minstrelsy was the only ticket to survive. Such became the reality for black actors, singers, composers, 1880s and 1920. Ernest Hogan, who's pictured here, right, who's not pictured, but his famous song, All Kuhns Look Alike to Me, is one of many African-American actors and musicians and entertainers that had to essentially go along with this because this was the only way to survive financially as well as entertainment. So such became the reality, as I said, for black actors, singers, composers. Ernest Hogan, Bob Cole, Ernest Walker, Ada Walker, Cicerita Jones, the Black Patty. Here's a song of Bob Cole and Billy Johnson. Mr. Coon, you're all right in your place. So maybe that didn't register to some people, but to, of course, in African American circles, that would, of course, register in quite a different way. You are okay as long as you stay in your place, so to speak. So here's another one of Bob Cole and Johnson, Give Me the Lemons. So the imagery reflects the intention, and so it's changed from T.D. Rice being a youthful person in the 1830s, creating this new device to make a name for himself, if you will. And this was cute, and it was also subversive, of course, because you were having basically a Irish immigrant who's preceding the Great Famine immigration of Irish people in the 1850s. But this is basically a lower class kind of thing, and the Bowery was a kind of, if you will, a lower social economic area of New York City. So you have this fun entertainment that becomes something totally different. So I want to go on to talk about the issue. I'm showcasing some of the rare song sheets I have in my collection. Look at the titles. I Don't Allow No Coon to Hurt My Feelings. It's actually written by Irving Jones, who's the shorter man on the left. And this is Irving Jones and several other well-known black entertainers at the time. I Ain't Obliged to Stand No Nigger Foolin'. This is a song actually written by Frank Walsh, but it's considered at its time as the greatest of all Coon songs. Another one, I Don't Care If You Never Does Come Back. The greatest darky song of the present era. What does it say here? With the great success by two real Coons, Williams and Walker. But who is it written by? Who's the publisher? That's another whole story. But let's go forward to this, because this is one of the areas that I specialize in. Okay, so Cicerita Jones. You've heard of Cicerita Jones. Cicerita Jones was actually a classically trained black singer whose voice was compared to celebrated white metropolitan opera singer Adelina Patti. She toured Germany and England in the 1870s, returned to the States to face the same reality that even though she was successful like her predecessors that were working before the war. I'm thinking of, I'm having a senior moment, but at Greenwood, there was a singer, I want to say Elizabeth Greenwood, and she was working in New York in the 1840s and 50s. She precedes, and if you will, sets the stage for a Cicerita Jones, a classically trained, a gifted singer, basically, who wanted to go and sing operatic material, but wasn't able to because of her race, but was able to go to Europe, and specifically to Germany and England in the 1870s. She came back and had to create a Black Patty's minstrel show. But what did she do? She did that, but she carved out a section of her minstrel shows to showcase her operatic talents and arias and songs associated with Adelina Patti. Wonderful woman, supposedly one of the great, and the godmother, if you will, of all African-American concert and operatic singers. Strangely enough, when I've had conversations with a couple of people here and elsewhere about why did she not make any cylinders, her years, I believe, were 1870-something to 1933. She was at the peak in all of the time that we're talking about. Cylinders, flat discs, as well as, I mean, she could have made, at the end of her career, you know, Victor could have connected with her for the, what is it called, the program transcription disc. But she never recorded for some strange reason. But she is considered really the grand diva and connected. But she was not able to survive. And then, and this is a classic piece from my archive, Black Patty, the famous Black Patty musical comedy team from 1913. This is what she had to do. So we go forward. By contrast, Burt Williams, born in the West Indies, a consummate black minstrel, was removed from the feelings of degradation associated with donning of burnt cork that plagued his black peers. For Williams, these are some images, famous photographs of Williams. For Williams, burnt cork was nothing more than clown makeup, irrespective of the cultural implications associated with it. The Coon song and the caricatured images of the late 19th century also found new life in Europe. German music houses and sheet music publishers found a new market with what in German is called a Negalieder album, which is basically a black album. And this particular image is of the most famous, der 14. bekanntesten Kunstsongs für eine mittelste Singstimme, for middle voice. So it's got English and German text. So they found that, so Kunstsongs went abroad. In England and France, embraced the new children's toy at the turn of the century and the black pickaninny caricature of the Gollywog. This is a rare book from my collection that showcases what was popular there. The Gollywog, like the coon image, was a playful, not to be taken serious person, a fictional person, but a person who could be laughed at, if you will. Here is the Gollywog, a popular toy you could buy, children's toy you could buy anywhere in England and France between 1890 and 1910. Of course, the Gollywog was, the image of the Gollywog was immortalized by Claude Debussy in his children's suite, the final movement, Gollywog's Cakewalk. So going forward, in dual and I call it dialectical contrast to the darkness of minstrelsy and Kunstsongs, Negro spirituals emerge to provide the road to freedom, since we're talking about Emancipation Proclamation, the road to freedom of conscious intent by blacks, both former slaves and free blacks, to define an authentic black cultural identity. The first publication of the collected Negro spirituals in 1867 coincided with the founding of the land-grant college, Fisk University in Nashville. The white choral music director, George White, had a novel fundraising idea. Assemble a choir of Negro singers as a touring ensemble, and then took that ensemble in the North and in Europe, and it worked with great success during the early 1870s through the early 1880s. The success of the Fisk Jubilee Singers during the period of the 1870s-80s that preceded the repressive Jim Crow laws inspired other Reconstruction-era land-grant colleges like Tuskegee Institute, Hampton Institute, to form spiritual ensembles that acted as dual agents of collegiate fundraising and cultural response to the reactionism of a reborn Confederacy that thundered with restrictive anti-black laws and local citizen militias who donned white hoods and sheets to signature a new order. Although briefly disbanding, a new Fisk Jubilee Singers ensemble would emerge in the early 1900s at a time when the critical thinking of progressive blacks intellectuals, such as pictured here, W.E. Du Bois in his landmark 1903, The Souls of Black Folk, would usher in a decisive push to reject the imposed darkness of Kunstsongs in favor of a moral and spiritual uplift of the Negro race, as it was called then, anchored in authentic songs of spirit, trial, and tribulation born out of the pain of slavery. So in 1909, Victor Records signed with great fanfare the Fisk Jubilee Singers in his quartet form with tenors John Wesley Work II, J.A. Myers, and baritone bass Noah Ryder and Alfred King to record Never Before. And this is from my collection. This is a 1912 Victor small catalog. Never before had a Negro spirituals ensemble been accorded a status of respect that was made especially evident in its extended showcase with their pictures and their names in the Victor catalogs from 1909 through at least 1912. This is a 1912 one, so in closing, despite the commercial success of Victor recordings of the Fisk Jubilee Singers, the double consciousness that W.E.B. Du Bois talks about in the Souls of Black Folks, this duality of identities of how blackness could be defined, i.e. Jim Crow and Zip Coon become caricature coonism and pre-Confederacy nostalgia for a happy slave versus an emerged new Negro, would find an unnerving coexistence for decades to come. Yet with a metaphorical biblical triumph of light over darkness, the proclamation of emancipation of the slave become new Negro would arise phoenixed through the ashes of a repressive Jim Crow South by the power of the spiritual song born out of the chains of slavery, songs of a steadfast belief in personal redemption through an undying faith anchored in the Old Testament Hebrew stories of a God of justice. And we close with a final video clip, a very short one, that showcases one of the most famous of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and certainly in film, the most famous of all of the Negro concert choirs, the Hall Johnson Choir. Please. Thank you.